For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Hey everybody, Mike Sullivan, back here in the book of Ephesians. If you were with us here last week, we were talking about how God is building his church. Now the word church here, just so we're on the same page, I just want to remind everybody, is not a physical space like a sanctuary or a building on a corner somewhere. The church is actually a community of people who know Christ. And we talked last week quite a bit about different ways that God has been building. The thing that we focused on the most is how he's laying this amazing foundation. If you read in the first part of Ephesians 4, there's a couple verses in there that basically describe what God's doing like it's a construction site. This is actually the site of the new Columbus Crew downtown soccer stadium, which is kind of exciting. You can see they poured footers, and they basically got the foundation in place. Now they're getting ready to build. So now what we're doing is we're as the church, we're coming in not to an empty construction site, but a place where God has already been at work, God already laying the foundation for the church. He describes how there's already one body and one spirit, one hope of our calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who's over all and through all and in all. So all these things God's already put in place to unify us. This one body he mentions is just how every Christian has been put into Christ. This is something that we can't see, but it's a spiritual reality. If you know Christ, we've all been knit together like interdependent organs in a human body, all part of Christ's body. This has already been set up. And so this is something that God's already been doing to build his church. Now, what we're going to focus on today is how, in addition to this, he's given us spiritual gifts to use to build the church. If you look in the Bible, there are lists in several different parts of the New Testament describing these gifts or empowerings, ways that God enables people to serve effectively, to build up the church in a variety of ways. Some of them are real practical, like administration. You've got some that involve just having, you know, deep wisdom to be able to counsel people or to be able to understand the Bible very effectively. You know, each Christian, the Bible teaches, has one or more of these gifts. And these are crucial to how we actually go onto that construction site and start building. If you look in our passage, starting in verse 11, he talks about how he gave some as apostles, how God gave some as prophets, some as evangelists, some as pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of service to the building up of the body of Christ. And these roles that he mentions here, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers, each one of those roles corresponds to a spiritual gift. There's a gift of apostleship, a gift of prophecy, a gift of evangelism. And so what we see is when individuals with those gifts exercise these roles, something happens. Paul says the church is built up. So there's a direct connection between the use of our gifts, each person pitching in, and the entire church being built up. And so laying the foundation, you know, setting down the footers, giving us something to build on, that's something that God has done. But he's also given the laborers, he's given us spiritual gifts that we can employ in building the church. Now, here's a key thing that I'm going to be asking, and we're going to spend a lot of time on this. Who plays key roles in building up the church? I mean, who are these gifted co-laborers that God permits to come onto this construction site and start building? There's really two broad views on this. The first view is that it's mainly the clergy. Now, when I say clergy, I mean pastors, priests, reverends, you know, folks that are paid professional Christians, paid to lead the church. In many church traditions, it's the clergy that does the bulk of the ministry, the bulk of the service that happens in the church. There are lay people. Lay people are folks that attend church, and they can serve in minor roles. They can help park cars. They can count money in the collection plate. They can run maybe a bake sale or something like that. But it's really clear that the visible, upfront, everybody kind of watching the person on the stage kinds of roles, the counselors, the teachers, the leaders, that's really set aside for the pros, for the clergy. So that's one view. Now, the other view, and the view that I'll be putting forth here, is that all Christians should be involved. And just to make sure you can see the contrast between these two different perspectives, I wanted to illustrate this a little bit. So with mainly the clergy view, you've got the clergy in the rectangles, and notice that the rectangles are different than the ovals in the congregation. The clergy really are in a separate class, and their role is to kind of build into the average Christian in their congregation. And a lot of the energy and the service and the creativity is coming from them, and it's directed toward their congregation. Whereas when we have the all-Christian view, notice there are leaders. The church needs to be led, but these leaders are just like people in their congregation. They shouldn't be seen as some separate special class. And their job isn't just to serve these guys, but to help people in their congregation develop ministry or service of their own. And so, and not just that, in an all-Christian model, everybody building up the church, sometimes a Christian might go off and start a whole new work. Just your average person. And so they're very different perspectives here on how the church should operate. Here's one more way to think about this. With the mainly the clergy view, you know, the congregation is in the stadium and we're watching the clergy on the field. We're watching the leaders do what they do. And we're like, wow, they're really good at that. But then we're also quietly kind of grateful that we don't have to do what they're doing. And there's that. That's the mainly the clergy view. But with this all-Christian view, I don't know if you remember when Michael Jordan was playing toward the end of his career with the Washington Wizards. But he was they had a head coach, but he was the coach on the team. He was a player coach. He was out there playing games. Clearly, though, he was the one calling the shots and directing how the team should function. And so that this picture of, yeah, a leader is a leader, but they're a leader among other people that they're on a team with doing something together. That's the all-Christian perspective. So who does play a role? I've said that it's all Christians. And you may be like, ah, whatever. I mean, why is that even controversial? Well, actually, the idea that everybody could be involved, not just a special few, in building up the church has been quite controversial over the years. You know, in the Middle Ages, your average person, your lay person, had little or no role in the church at all. In fact, this verse was often cited when people would talk about the lay people potentially serving with the clergy. This is what would be thrown at them. You should not plow with an ox and an ass harnessed together. So you can imagine in this arrangement who the ass is, right? The ass is the bumbling, you know, unknowledgeable church member, the lay person, who's just going to get in there and mess things up. And so for centuries, in most churches, I mean hundreds of years, all the ministry was being done by the clergy. Very little was being done by lay people. And that way of operating has continued to our own day. And in many groups, that's still the way things are set up. And so it's really important. You may be like, okay, I'm ready to move on to the next point. But I really want to double down and talk about this a bit more and talk about why this passage that we're looking at actually supports the view that every Christian should be involved in building up the church. Think about a millipede. Okay, this, I know it's gross, and I apologize for that. But a millipede has a lot of legs. When I was a little kid, I used to think it was like a million legs. But actually, it's like 80 to 100 legs. But I'll tell you what, this thing, this big thing will not move unless all of these legs are working. If there, just imagine something this big, only two or three or four legs moving. That is not going to get this whole insect in motion or whatever. I guess it's not an insect. But you know what I mean. It takes everyone, all these legs collaborating. That's how the church works. And in this passage, that's the case that Paul makes all the way through. All Christians build up the church. Think about this from the role of leaders. You know, we talked in these two verses we've looked at already, how there are leaders. And it's true, these different gifts and these roles are associated with leadership. It's not one-to-one, but these are associated with leadership in the New Testament. But what are these leaders supposed to do? I mean, these are leaders, but what are they supposed to work on? Are they supposed to run around and do everything? No, he says that the role of these people in these leadership positions is to equip the saints for the work of service. Now, the saints here, you know, you hear this, and we think of some special holy class of people. That's not true. In the New Testament, a saint is just a Christian. If you know Christ, you're a saint. All Christians are saints. And so the role of pastors and apostles, these people that play different roles, leadership-type roles in the church, it's to equip the saints, to equip all Christians for the work of service. So yeah, everybody, not just a few. Now, what about the goal? Think about this question of who should do this related to the goal that we're shooting for. It goes on in the next verse in this passage. It says that God's going to keep building his church until we all attain to the unity of the faith and to the knowledge of the Son of God, to a mature man, to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. Okay, so what's the whole thing moving toward? What are we building toward? He says the goal is that all of us attain to maturity, all of us to a mature man are becoming more like Christ. And so think about that. What is maturity? Isn't a key part of maturity loving people? I mean, could you imagine having somebody who won't lift a finger to help anybody else and saying that they're mature? That's nuts. That's not Christ-like. God wants everybody to be mature. Maturity involves service. And so all Christians obviously should be involved in that. What about this, too? Think about how we reach our goal. How are we going to get to the place where the entire church is seeing everyone, not just a select few, but everybody growing toward maturity? How's that going to happen? Well, the rest of our passage explains, as a result, we're no longer to be children tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness and deceitful scheming, but speaking the truth in love, we're to grow up in all aspects into him who is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body, being fit and held together by what every joint supplies according to the proper working of each individual part, causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. And so it's clear, again, what's the goal we're shooting for? We're to grow up. The whole growth of the body, that we're supposed to be built up, that's the goal. But how is that going to happen? How are we going to get there? Well, he says it's going to be by what every joint supplies. And look how precise he is. Just like in a human body, every joint has to work for it to grow. He says if we're going to move forward as a church, it will require the proper working of each individual part. Every leg on the millipede has to be moving for the church to move toward maturity. And so it's indisputable. I could show you passage after passage where Paul and other authors in the New Testament are pleading with the church, just imploring them. Everyone's got to be involved in advancing God's work. And so why is this such a big deal? Well, on a personal level, just thinking about my own situation, when I came out to this church, I came out, I think it was 1982, believe it or not. And I went for probably 18 months before I ever spoke with one of the founding pastors. I would see him, you know, I'd sit in a teaching and I'd see him up front teaching. But I never spoke to them. I didn't even know who they were that well. And, you know, what really made the difference in my life wasn't some of these, you know, big leaders. It was the people sitting right next to me. It was just average Christians. It was just the lay people, folks that were maybe a little further along in the Lord than I was, that took an interest in me, that helped get me established and up on my feet and walking with God. And I'll tell you, if we, not just because we prefer it, but if we don't have Bible-based convictions that this is the way the church has to be, we're in trouble. This is so crucial. We will never see a single pastor, a single group of leaders be able to love and care for the church the way the mobilized body of Christ can. There's nothing like it when you see a whole room full of people committed to contributing. I pray to God that's the kind of church I'm involved in for the rest of my life. We can never lose this. Yep, and the other thing you got to realize too, and this is just history, is in every movement, we always drift toward letting leaders do everything. There's the ego-driven side of it where the leader wants to be seen as the one who's got it right. But then there's also our own sinful tendency to just want to offload stuff onto somebody else. This is human nature, and we're going to have to resist it. And to resist it, we need convictions from the Word about why it has to be all Christians building up the church. There's a lot at stake. Really have to have this. So what are some of the implications if this is true? Here's a key one. This is a really key implication. If you're a leader, your job is to mobilize other people. Yeah, this is one of your key jobs. We have people in this church leading in a variety of settings. We have folks leading clusters of home churches. We have home group leaders. We have people leading small Bible studies called cell groups. We have these things called ministry teams that are focused on specific needs, and people lead those. And so I know as I'm talking right now, many of you listening are leading in some setting like that. And so what is the thing that, like, at the essence a leader should be doing there? Here's a big one, is asking this question: what am I doing that I can teach somebody else to do? I mean, I'm sure whatever you're doing as a leader in whatever role you're in, I'm sure you're great at it. But a big part of our job is to let other people who aren't so great at it learn to get better at serving in different ways as we step aside and lift them up. So can you think of something other people can do in the ministry that you're involved in? What about teaching them how to do it? And then here's another crucial one. This is very important. What am I unable to do that I need help with? You know, I was involved in a ministry to low-income children for about 10 years. And I was one of the leaders. And I'll tell you, there were so many needs beyond our ability. So many things that needed to be done. I had no clue how to do these things. And so fortunately, God assembled a team of people, most of whom were not leading, but many had skills that they could do things I never could have done. And they did them so well. And they were absolutely crucial to us serving the students that we were given to serve effectively. So, man, I'm just saying, you just have to recognize there's so many things you are never going to be able to do as well as the people that you're leading can do. So both of these things, if you're a leader, boy, those are some questions to continually ask yourself. Now, if you're not a leader, and I know a lot of folks listening to this aren't currently leading anything, I would just say the gap, you know, that you may perceive between you and a leader is way smaller than you think. We tend to put leaders on a pedestal. We want to put them in a separate class. That's just human nature. But in the Bible, the way leaders are described is something closer just to the normal Christian life. You know, these are character qualities of leaders. You can read about these in several different passages. Things like being above reproach or having a good reputation or just having some self-control. You've got quite a big list. Here's the thing, though. Most of them are character qualifications. And I could, if I had time, I could show you a Bible verse where this concept, being above reproach, is a goal for not just for leaders, but for every single Christian. What is this? This is the normal Christian life. Even in something that is a specialized skill, like this one, like able to teach God's word, you know, it doesn't say what setting that happens in. It could be a large meeting. It could be on YouTube. It could be a smaller setting like a home Bible study. It could be just with a person or two. The principle is, are you learning the Bible and then taking what you're learning and giving it away to somebody else? And so when you pull back and you just think about this. This is something any Christian should aspire to. In fact, you know, when we think about a leader isn't defined by some kind of degree or they've reached some kind of certain, you know, threshold or sound barrier. What is a leader? A leader is just somebody who isn't just talking about the Christian life, but they're modeling it and living it. That's all this is. You know, years ago, the leaders, the paid leaders in Xenos used to work in this building. This is at Weber and I-71, right by the railroad tracks. And it was just part of this building, like the upper or lower level, I forget. But anyhow, when I was really new to this church, I was going to a weekly Bible study in one of the conference rooms in this building. And I remember coming in and just feeling like, oh man, this is like, maybe this is like sacred space. You know, the people that work here, these are like the leaders of the church. I just remember having that sense of, like, you know, this is different. And so for a year, I would go here once a week and study the Bible with people. And it was a transforming experience for me personally. But I also remember one time I was sitting on a couch in one of these conference rooms and joking around about leading. And a guy that was there who actually was on staff was over by the copy machine. He took the papers he was about to copy, he set them down, and he looked at me and he said, have you ever thought about leading? Have you ever thought about the possibility that you could serve and play a significant role in this church? You know, and I, up to that point, I never had. But then he went on to explain that a leader is just a Christian who's following Christ, who's living out some of those things that were described there. And so that, just keep that in mind. No one's going to appoint you as a leader against your will and just usher you into some situation you're not ready for. In this church, we recognize leaders. We just go up to people and go, you're living the kind of life that Christ calls us to live, the kind of life we would want to put in front of other people. How about helping us out and leading on a home church leadership team? That's how it happens. It's not some huge leap. There's not some huge gap between like following Christ and leading for Christ. They're very similar. Here's one more thing, an implication. You can play a significant role in our church. That's right. We've got some traditions. You think about just things you're limited to. You can do this. You could serve over here in this kids ministry or whatever. But these visible roles are really not for you. Not true in the early church. If you remember when Ben taught, he talked about how a great persecution began against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria. Okay, so this is really early on. The church in Jerusalem was under persecution. They're scattered except for the apostles. Okay, so the main leaders of the church stayed in Jerusalem, and everybody else, the average Christians, took off. But look what happened after a little bit. It says in verse 4 that those who had been scattered went about preaching the word. And what we find out is that soon after that, we start reading about churches popping up in the area near Jerusalem and just a little bit beyond. Who started those churches? We know one church was started by a guy named Philip, who was a leader, but many of them were started by people whose names had been lost to history, average Christians that were powerfully used to start new works in new places. And so the idea that God might be nudging you, that God might be, kind of moving you toward opening your eyes to your ability to serve and make a difference, That's consistent with God. He uses unlikely candidates to do powerful works in the church. And so I just would urge you, you know, if you're sitting here, and maybe not right now, but maybe at some point recently you felt God nudging you to step up and take on some new ministry role of some kind, don't talk yourself off the ledge. Don't disqualify yourself. God uses people just like you to do great works for him. So I just really would plead with you, you can play a significant role. Now, what is it going to take to have everybody building, everybody involved in this? Well, one, we're going to have to be connected to Christ. This is so crucial. You know, if you remember in this whole picture of the body, the us all being, you know, interdependent, working together to grow this whole church, we grow up in all aspects into him who is the head, even Christ. Okay, all of this is connected to Jesus Christ. If we lop his head off, if we function as if he's not the head, if we don't have a living connection with Christ, all of this totally falls apart. This is why Jesus says in the upper room on the night before he died, he said, look, I'm the vine. You're the branches. If you abide in me and I in you, you'll bear much fruit. But apart from me, you can do nothing. In Greek, by the way, that means nothing. Absolutely nothing. It doesn't matter how studied we are, whatever. We'll get nothing done for God. No building of the church apart from being tight with Jesus Christ. I wonder if you're persuaded about this. This is a long question, but it's important. Are you persuaded that gifting, equipping, commitment, that none of this is going to amount to anything unless you're connected to Christ? That's what Christ is saying. Trying hard enough is not enough. We have to be knit in with Christ. And I realize some of us here, that may seem super vague, like super hard to get your brain around. And so I would just ask you, can you remember a time when not just coming to church, but that you personally in your heart approached Jesus and said, I want to have a relationship with you? When you acknowledge, like this verse talks about, that I've done things wrong, I can sense this wall separating me from you because of the way I've lived. I recognize that needs to be dealt with. Where you reached out to him and recognized when he died on the cross, he was paying the debt of your sin. This verse says that God presented Jesus as a sacrifice and that we're made right with God when we believe that he sacrificed his life, shedding his blood for us. But it's important to ask yourself, when in the past have you actually gone to Jesus and had this kind of interaction with him where you've said, I want what you did on the cross to apply to me? You know, once we do that, that's how you become a Christian. That's how we establish this living connection with Jesus. And that's where we get God's life and power and wisdom and strength. We receive it from him and we give it away to other people. That's the essence of ministry. So yeah, that's a key thing we're going to have. Here's something else, is speaking the truth in love. I want to go back through this one part. He says, as a result, we should not be children tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness and deceitful scheming, but speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in all aspects into him who is the head, even Christ. Okay, he mentions something here, doctrine. This is what the Bible says is true about God, true about the way the world is. These are truths in the Bible that God has revealed. And he's pointing out a common problem, the problem of false doctrine, how over the centuries, people have been led astray into false teachings. And he's saying that this is a real threat to the growth of the church. And you may be like, well, yeah, that's true, but let's let the experts handle that. I mean, isn't it the leader's job to protect us? Well, that's a pretty questionable strategy. If you know anything about the history of the church, some of the worst errors that have ever occurred have happened because leaders have led the church astray. We cannot just hope that the leaders get it right. Instead, he says he's talking about your average Christian are no longer to be children. And so This idea that we shouldn't be children, that means that we have to collectively raise our awareness of what the Bible teaches and become more familiar with it. Look at what it says about the church in Rome. Paul says, concerning you, my brethren, I myself, I'm convinced that you're full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able also to admonish one another. These guys knew God's truth well enough to actually be able to correct each other if necessary. And so if we're going to have this, what are we going to have? Individuals in our church with an avid interest in learning the Bible. I was thinking a lot of people get overwhelmed when they think about learning about a book as big as the Bible, but we can do it. Think about the Harry Potter series. Harry Potter, 4,224 pages. That's all seven books. Okay, what about the Bible? My study Bible has a little over 2,000 pages. Now, you might be like, oh, well, come on. You know, the print's really small and stuff like that. Well, if you go by words, a little over 1 million words in Harry Potter, and the English Bible is around 780,000. So, I mean, I'm just saying, if you know what a Horcrux is, if you know what who the characters are, if you can quote verbatim a couple spells, if you've read these books through a few times, I think you can learn the Bible. I think you can learn its major themes, who the key players are, what it says about history. You might even be able to memorize a few parts of it. This is a realistic, doable goal, and it's mission critical. Okay, now, of course, we can do that, but it's not just enough to know it. We have to speak it in love. That's so crucial. You know, when I was a brand new Christian, I actually reached a point where I was persuaded that the Old Testament couldn't be God's word. I just was reading stuff in it, and I was like, no way, I just can't. This cannot be what God wrote. And I had a friend in my life who was further along than me. He was a leader, and he didn't flip out. He listened. He steered me towards some great books and resources, really good evidence that the Old Testament actually is inspired. It's the product of God, filled with predictions that have come true and so on. But I would not have listened to this guy. I wouldn't have listened to him unless I really knew he loved me. Him and his wife just kind of took me in and cared for me, and it was their willingness to love me that helped me receive what they were saying. It was so crucial, so important that when we speak the truth, we're speaking from a position of real concern and love. That's why Paul said many of the things he spoke with tears, because he was deeply concerned. Think about movies. I love sports movies, but you think about Hoosiers, or you think about Remember the Titans, you know, where you see these coaches change the culture of the team. And the team comes together and they accomplish something great. What's happening there? What those coaches bring to the culture is truth speaking in love. Now, I'm just saying, if we don't have this in the church, we're going to fizzle out. People are going to be like, what are we trying to do here? This is just mushy and pointless. But if we have speaking the truth in love, that's going to be dynamite. That's when we're going to start to see people change and grow and move forward. So yeah, that's when we'll grow up, like it says here, into all aspects, into him who is the head, even Christ. Now, one last thing. I don't want you to have the impression that only leaders have gifts. Look at this. It says a spiritual gift is given to each of us so that we can help each other. And so anybody here that's a Christian has one or more gifts. And I realize when people think about gifts, it's not that we don't have one. We do. And it's not that many Christians aren't willing to use their gift. They are. The chronic issue that I see folks struggle with, that I struggled with for years, is trying to figure out what my gift is. And so if you're here and you're like, let me at it, I want to serve, and you don't know what your gift is, you can ask other Christians. You could take a test. We used to have a test. I don't think it's a great way to do it, but look me up, or you know, maybe figure out a way to contact me. I'll send you a spiritual gift test. Or you could use the Roomba method. In this method, if you know what a Roomba is, you just kind of ping pong around the room, vacuuming things, just randomly sweeping around, just trying to be useful, sweeping things up. What if you were to just go into settings where you're just serving and contributing and just kind of learning through trial and error by this attempt worked out, that one didn't, and then over time with getting feedback from people, you start to zero in on how you're gifted. That's the way it usually works. So here's my thing. This is really the whole point of this teaching. You've been empowered by God to play an important role in building up His church. Your self-perception on this is very important. Is this how you see yourself? This is how every one of us needs to see ourselves. So yeah, just let that hang there. This is the right way to view each of our lives.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.